From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition, actress Glenn Close, she's reprising her role as Cruella de Vil in the sequel 102 Dalmatians, which opens next week for the holiday. Also, an interview with science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. This week, he was awarded a special medal at the National Book Awards ceremony. His books include The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451. World music critic Milo Miles reviews the new CD from Senegalese singer Youssou N'Dour. And Henry Sheehan reviews You Can Count on Me, an independent film starring Laura Linney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie 102 Dalmatians opens next week for the holiday weekend. It's a sequel to the 1996 live-action remake of the classic animated feature. The role of the evil Cruella de Vil is played in both films by one of the most respected actresses of her generation, Glenn Close. Her films include Fatal Attraction, The Big Chill, The World According to Garp, Jagged Edge, Dangerous Liaisons, and Air Force One. She won a Tony for her performance as the faded film star Norma Desmond in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Sunset Boulevard. I spoke with Close in 1996, after the release of 101 Dalmatians, the story of a newlywed couple and their two lovely Dalmatians who are having puppies. This happy home is threatened by the monstrous fashion plate Cruella de Vil, who has a passion for fur. Spotted Dalmatian fur would be unique, so she offers to buy those Dalmatian pups and turn their coats into her coat.
£500. £7,500. Yeah? £2 per spot.
Cruella, what would you do with 15 puppies?
Yeah, that's irrelevant, idiot. She can't have any because they're not for sale.
I'm getting very tired of you, Roland.
Roger.
Whatever. Puppies are not for sale. Okay. Sure.
Yes.
All right. Keep the little beasts. Do what you like with them. Drown them for all I care. You're a fool, Anita. I've no use for fools. You're fired. You're finished. You'll never work in fashion again. I'm through with all of you. Hold your even. Just wait. You'll be sorry. You fools! You idiots!
Glenn Close, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, Cruella de Vil, who you play in 101 Dalmatians, do you see any connection between her and the character of Norma Desmond that you played in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical of Sunset Boulevard? The character originated
only that
with
we wear
Davis,
red yeah. lipstick and mm-hmm. Certain animal fur. I think I actually felt more of a connection between Cruella and the Marquise de Merteuil in Dangerous Liaisons.
Oh, yeah.
I think they are masters of what I call the great game, and they're gleeful in the playing of that game. To me, Norma Desmond was a very, very fragile creature who only could survive on her illusions, and when those illusions were broken, she was destroyed. But Cruella is invincible. Cruella will never be vanquished.
And like the character in Dangerous Liaisons, she sees life as a game too, where you just like manipulate all the characters on the board.
Yes.
For a more
but
favorable
again,
outcome.
Cruella is not as vulnerable even as the Marquise, because Cruella is truly the devil. As she in the original Dodie Smith novelette, which is absolutely charming, she is the devil. Her food is black and tastes of pepper, and that's why she loves to swathe herself in fur, because the hotter she is, the happier she is because of where she comes from.
You were 35 when you had your first film role, The World According to Garp. Had you tried for movies earlier on?
Yes, but not very well. I've never been good at walking into a room as me and convincing somebody that I can play somebody else. I've always been very, very uncomfortable. And I think my career has literally been one evidence of what I can do leading to another, you know. And a lot of times, even when people see you in something, they don't necessarily think you in another kind of role. They fit you into what you've done before.
So had you auditioned for roles but not auditioned well before?
Well, it was a lot of, yeah, I guess. It's very hard when you're handed two pages out of a 115-page script.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that was rather unfair.
You don't know who you are.
Or the stacking of it's like, you know, if you're lucky. I always never minded if I didn't get cast, if I felt I'd shown them my best. Then I never minded it, because I thought, well, you know, you can only do your best. The frustrating thing times is when you're sitting there and you can feel that edge slowly draining out the ends of your fingertips, and it's desperate because it all becomes terribly kind of psychological. And when you feel that you haven't shown your best, that's very difficult. And I must say, I have written letters and asked if I could please come back. And sometimes people let you, and sometimes they don't.
Fatal Attraction was a role that just really kind of stunned people. This was a role you really went after, I think. This is a role you asked to audition for?
I met with Stanley Jaffe, who's one of the producers, and I remember meeting him in a hotel lobby in New York, and we had tea or something, and I had a little demure kind of summer straw hat on and a loose kind of peasant dress. I couldn't have been more opposite of Alex Forrest, but I had felt very passionately about the character, and I was able to kind of articulate to him the kind of thing that I was thinking about, and I guess that interested him and him enough to ask that I do a audition with Michael Douglas on video out in California, which I then did, and I thought, I wanted to kill myself afterwards. I thought for sure I hadn't gotten the part.
Why?
Because it was just so, please, to walk into a room and there's Michael Douglas and a video camera set up. It's pretty intimidating. And I had long hair at the time, and I didn't know what to wear, so I went to a store and I found this black, wonderful cotton dress. At that time, it had big shoulders and a very small waist and kind of a great skirt. And I wore that, and then that morning I didn't know what to do with my hair. I've never been good knowing how to do my own hair, so I just, I'll just let it go wild. I can't deal with it. So my hair was all over the place. I had that black dress on. And then I was so nervous that I took, I think, a half of Valium, which I never do. And I remember kind of weaving across the parking lot to get to the audition. And, you know, then go up, there's the camera, there's Adrian Lyne, and what happened.
Now, I know the ending of Fatal Attraction was reshot. You didn't want it to be reshot. And you protested it, but what could you do to protest it when the ending was rewritten?
Just refused to do it. Because I had grown to really love that character very much. I'd done a lot of research about her, and with psychiatrists, just to understand, first of all, if her behavior was possible, and then when I found out that it was, to then explore what would create behavior like that. And in that research, I really started to love that character. And she was not a psychopath. She was suicidal. She was self-destructive. And the original script was a beautiful, seamless film noir. And they started kind of tinkering with it. And then we shot the original ending where she kills herself and with the same knife that his fingerprints are on, and he goes off to jail.
So her death frames him.
Yeah, and it was so incredibly upsetting to the American audiences, who really like happy endings, and that they reshot it, rewrote it.
So tell me, give me a sense of some of the things you learned from the psychiatrist that really helped you understand the character and figure out how to play her.
Well, in that character, never has a chance to explain to the audience, or the audience never really understands her history or why she's doing what she's doing. So I had to really know myself.
Just for our listeners who haven't seen the movie Fatal Attraction, let me say that your character is a character who basically picks up or helps seduce a married man. And then when he doesn't want to see her anymore, she just goes after him with a vengeance and threatens the safety of the entire family. And becomes,
well, she's also discovered she's pregnant by him.
Right. And the rejection of her sends her into this
obsession.
Obsession, yeah. Thank you. Retaliative obsession. Retaliatory obsession. Mm. So back to the insights that psychiatrists gave you that helped you understand this character and helped you play her.
Well, it was a long process. And but, for example, there is a scene where my character sneaks up to their house and looks in the window and sees the parents giving the little girl the pet rabbit. And then she runs away from the window and throws up in the bushes. And I thought, okay. I said, what would cause that? And they said, well, whatever that she would, she sees herself as that child. And the research and, you know, what we had figured out from her behavior, which actually is impeccably written, is that she was a woman who had probably been sexually abused by her father at a very early age. And when looking in that window, she associates herself with that child, and all those subliminal feelings, all that guilt, all that revulsion comes up when she sees the father being so attentive and loving to the child. And that those feelings and the actual physical feelings that she would have gone through as a child through what her father might have, you know, forced her to do makes her throw up.
Now, could you go to the writer of the screenplay and ask him to share these kinds of insights, or would the writer be more unreliable in understanding the psychological motivation?
I didn't, you know, the writer wasn't around much, but, you know, I didn't need to, because with the work I did with the psychiatrist, he had written a pretty seamless case study.
Uh-huh.
In fact, for 3 years after that movie came out, I was asked to speak to the Association of American Psychiatrists at their big meeting. You know, and I said, why? It was just a character I created. I don't know, but it was that real and that... I guess believable for them, and I've been told by a lot of psychiatrists that that part brought a lot of people to their couches.
My guest is Glenn Close. Here she is with Michael Douglas in a scene from Fatal Attraction.
I don't know what you're up to, but I'm going to tell you it's going to stop right now.
No, it's not going to stop. It's going to go on and on until you face up to your responsibilities.
What responsibilities?
I'm pregnant. I'm going to have our child.
Alex, that's your choice, honey. That has nothing to do with me.
I just want to be a part of your life.
Oh, this is the way you do it, huh? Showing up at my apartment?
What am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
You don't get it. You don't get it.
Don't you remember our weekend? It wasn't that wonderful. Why can't we just be like that again? I know you feel it, too. I mean, what are you so afraid of?
Hey, just don't flatter yourself, Alex. You're so sad. You know that, Alex? Lonely and very sad.
Don't you ever pity me, bastard.
I'll pity you. You're sick.
Why? Because I won't allow you to treat me like some slut you can just bang a couple of times and throw in the garbage? I'm going to be the mother of your child. I want a little respect.
You want respect.
What are you doing? Please, Dan. Please don't go. I didn't mean it. Please, I'm sorry. I'll tell your wife.
You tell my wife, I'll kill you.
Glenn Close will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Glenn Close. She's starring in the new movie, 102 Dalmatians. I've just gotten in a copy of your father's memoir, A Doctor's Story, and you were at the introduction to the book. This is the new paperback edition, and he was a surgeon in Africa for many years before moving back to the States, and he, I think, worked on the first outbreak of the Ebola virus.
Yes.
In Zaire. Mm-hmm. And part of his memoir, set at a time of your life that I know has been a source of a lot of confusion for you, because your father first went to Africa as a member of a group called Moral Rearmament, mm-hmm. which from what I've read and from the way he describes it sounds like part missionary and part cult group.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And you were, while he was living in Africa, spending some of the time in Africa and some of the time at a boarding school that I think was run by this group?
No. When he first went to Africa, we were in Switzerland, actually, at one of the headquarters for that group. And we actually went down the mountain every morning to quite a raucous English school filled with, you know, kids from all over the place. That was 2 years. And then after that, I came back to America and I went into Rosemary Hall, which was in Greenwich, Connecticut at the time.
Did you learn interesting things about your father's motivation for being in this group by reading the book?
Yes, I actually, you know, I kind of put off reading the book. I think I was a little wary of reading it because that was a difficult chapter in our whole family's life. And finally, my mom, who was a magnificent lady, said, "Have you read your dad's book?" And I said, "No." She said, "I think you better read it." And so I read it, and I was very, very moved by it. And I'm very proud of my father. I always have been, actually. He's an extraordinary man. And I think the older I get, the more proud I am of both my parents and what they have tried to achieve in the world and the kind of human beings that they are. And I think every family has, dramas and triumphs and tragedies. And I think my family are a group of very diverse, wonderful people.
And then he left Moral Rearmament after they urged him to stop operating, to stop performing surgery, and basically return to the pulpit. But he says he was determined to follow his own vocation. How did you leave?
Oh, let's see.
I'm assuming that my
the beginning of my the thing that marked my being able to get out of the grips of that group was when I went to college. And I was a freshman in college when I was 22 years old. And when I went to college, which was William and Mary in Virginia, I made the conscious decision that I would not trust any of my instincts because I felt they had been fed to me. And for that reason, I really started to come alive. I really started to be myself. And one of the first things I did as a freshman was walk into the theater department and audition for the very first play of the season, which was Twelfth Night.
Now, what made you realize at that point in your life, at this point of great transition and great insecurity in a way, that what you wanted to do was act?
I always had wanted to act.
Oh.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that they never really got me because I always had a sense of what I could do. And I think my dreams probably kept me from being totally brainwashed.
Now, I know you sang for a while with Up With People. Was that connected to...
That was an outcrop of Moral Rearmament. But I think it eventually broke away from it. I've long lost touch with them.
No, I mean, Up With People, as I remember, was just the most kind of square, clean-cut, cheery singing group, or chorus, I guess you could say.
In the 60s.
Yeah, and just as like the world is in this total, like, chaos, counterculture and rebellion, like, Up With People is really there, toeing the line, being really, really
freedom isn't free.
Clean cut, I wonder what it was like to have to sing with a smile all the time. I mean, that's my memories of Up With People, too. Everybody's
I had no equipment at the time to get out of it. I mean, I had been basically in something like that from the time I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you do the best you can with the emotional, spiritual equipment that you have. And I think hopefully we always will be evolving and able to take care of ourselves better and better as we go through life. But I had no equipment. And I was incredibly sincere, but I was very manipulated.
Right.
And so it took a while for me to be able to have the wherewithal to break away. And the thing that helped me break away was thinking to myself, I have to get an education. I am ignorant. I am an ignorant person. I have to go to school. And that was what helped me break away.
So did you break away about the same time your parents did, or was there any conflict
between
you?
No, actually, I was in it longer than they were.
Wow.
They were in Africa.
Uh-huh.
I got out of it in 1970, really, when I went to William and Mary.
Did you go through a period of big rebellion after you left?
No, I'd never really been a rebel. But I had terrible dreams. I think a lot of the terrible conflict and anger actually came out in my dreams. For years, I dreamed, first of all, of being totally in their thrall. And slowly in my dreams, I started to, sometimes it was even getting up from a table and walking away. And finally evolved to where I could say, confront them and say, no, you are wrong. And then I didn't have to dream about it anymore. Hmm. But I also had, at the same time, an incredible, joyous discovery of theater. And something which I had always wanted to do. And I think that sustained me and helped me grow.
Glenn Close, recorded in 1996. She stars as Cruella de Vil in the new movie 102 Dalmatians. It opens next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Doesn't scare you, no evil thing will. To see her is to take a sudden chill. Cruella, Cruella de Vil. The glare in her look, the eyes in her stare. Innocent children, you better beware. The world was such a wholesome place until Cruella, Cruella de Vil.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause, by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an interview with science fiction writer Ray Bradbury, author of Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles. This week he was given a special medal at the National Book Awards ceremony. Also, we have reviews of Yusu Endor's new CD and the new movie, You Can Count on Me. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senegal's Youssou N'Dour remains one of the most well-known Afropop performers in this country, even after a six-year absence from the American music scene. He's currently touring the U.S. with a new album. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
Hey. Considering all the difficulties African performers face in the international marketplace, Senegal's Youssou N'Dour has had an exemplary career. Neither dream come true nor cautionary tale. He began as a prodigy in the 1970s, fronting a major band when he was only 17. His voice was big and sweet, his charm transcended cultural barriers, and he was quite ambitious. He pioneered a progressive style called Mbalax, or remains ubiquitous in Senegal. By the middle 1980s, he had a rock star sponsor in Peter Gabriel and was making crossover records filled with jazzy funk touches and his ringing voice. By 1994, he had struggled his way into a moderate hit, 7 Seconds, which was not terrible. N'Dour then dropped off the American scene, and that could have been that. But remember, foreign stars who stop trying to conquer the U.S. do not stop making music or join top 40 cover bands. N'Dour went his way with albums released in Senegal, and though few Americans heard them, they were adventurous, intoxicating collections. And now, though nobody was expecting it, he's come back with Joko, The Link, an album that fulfills his original promise. N'Dour used to want a lot more from Western styles than he could digest. His overreach made even strong earlier albums like Set seem hollow at times. On Joko, he has a clear idea of what he wants, even as he remains more himself. The chorus of Barima wouldn't be so expansive and precise without deep understanding of modern pop methods. And his African percussion from the little tama drums on down has never been so carefully articulated as in this layered blowout from Bekat. Whether he's singing in Senegalese Wolof or English, Youssou N'Dour remains an idealist in touch with the everyday, whether he's praising a determined farmer or decrying persistent power outages. Joko is an uplifting journey without a false step. The same might be said for the second album by singer and bandleader Cheikh Lo, a close associate of N'Dour's. It's called Bumbe Guige, and to American ears, it might suggest a meditative activist soul record. Lowe is a lighter, dreamier singer than N'Dour, and more overtly religious. He speaks for the downtrodden just as eloquently, and has a profound flair for sweet, plaintive horn sections, directed here by R&B veteran Pee Wee Ellis. You know, there could even be some hit singles on Bumbe Guige. Fortunately, Cheikh Lo and Youssou N'Dour are proof that there is flourishing artistic life with or without American hits. Africa, Kasabali, kele bimogoti nende ya kele magi nende. Dile kikolo mjemu na yele pete, kalube kasabali, kele bimogoti nende kele magi nende.
Music from a new recording by Chuck Lowe. Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yusu Endur performs in New York on Sunday, Boston on Monday, and ends his tour in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. Coming up, an interview with science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. This is Fresh Air. The National Book Awards were announced Wednesday evening at a ceremony in Manhattan. The Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters was given to the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. His books include Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes, The Martian Chronicles, and The Illustrated Man. About his writing, Bradbury has said he likes to deal with human problems, such as what would it be like to be an average woman on the night before she goes off to Mars to join her husband? I spoke with him in 1988 after the publication of The Toynbee Convector, a collection of short stories. The first story gave a new twist to one of the oldest ideas in science fiction, the time machine. Bradbury explained what motivated him to write the story.
The problem of the world is doomsayers. We're surrounded by negative people. I can't stand them. I found out about them when I was 9 years old. Everyone made fun of me in the fourth or fifth grade because I collected the Buck Rogers comic strips. That was 1929. The future was never going to arrive. And I've been surrounded by people who never believed in the future. And it was true then, it's true today. So in that particular year, I tore up my comic strips, and a month later, I burst into tears and said to myself, why am I weeping? Who died? And the answer was me. I'd allowed these fools to kill me and kill the future. So from that time on, I decided I'd never listen to another damn fool again in my life. And I went back and collected the Buck Rogers comic strips and insured my future and began to write about it, became a writer. So I've learned that by doing things, things get done. I'm not an optimist. I'm an optimal behaviorist. So that particular story in my new book, The Toynbee Convector, is based on my conviction that we insure the future by doing it.
I want to ask you about another short story in your new collection, The Toynbee Convector. The story is called The Thing at the Top of the Stairs, and it's about an adult who's very afraid of the dark, as he was as a child, and he's afraid of walking up a staircase, an unlit staircase. There's a bulb that he has to turn on at the top of the staircase, and he's afraid that waiting at the top of the staircase is a monstrous thing. Were you afraid of the dark when you were young?
Yeah, that's a true story. When I was 4 or 5, 6 years old, we had the bathroom upstairs. And in the middle of the night when I had to go up there, I had to run halfway up the stairs, turn on the light before I could go the rest of the way. Well, when I was doing this, I'd always say to myself, now don't look at the top of the stairs because it will be waiting for you. And I never learned not to look because as soon as I looked up, there it was. And it was horrible. And I would scream and fall back down the stairs, and my mother or father would get up and sigh and say, oh, my God, here we go again. And they'd turn the light on for me and let me go upstairs. And so this is a vivid memory in my mind, and I write it so that other people, I suppose, reading it, will remember their own thing at the top of the stairs.
What shape did that it have in your mind?
That's a very hard thing to describe. I suppose it had a different shape every single night, maybe as the result of my seeing certain horror films that I dearly loved. You know, we all love horror films. And I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame when I was 3, The Phantom of the Opera when I was 6. I think The Phantom stayed with me the longest, and it was probably The Phantom up there, with the moment when Patsy Ruth Miller tears off the mask of Lon Chaney and his face is revealed in all its gruesome detail.
I'm glad you mentioned The Hunchback of Notre Dame, too, because it's a movie I used to watch over and over and over again when I was growing up. The first time I saw it, it just terrified me. But I had to keep watching it again and again. I loved it so much. Did that movie scare you?
I don't know if it scared me, it touched me. Even when you're 3 years old, the Lon Chaney version was very sympathetic and sad and very moving. And then the Charles Laughton version was the same way. I think all of us, no matter how we look, born into this world, feel something like the hunchback. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you have a beautiful face or not. I've talked to a lot of beautiful people in later years and found out that they went through the same thing in high school that I did. I went around with my face down most of the time because I was suffering from the usual outbreaks on the face that most kids of that age have. But then in later years, I met some beautiful women and beautiful men, and they all confessed to the same feeling, regardless of how they looked. I think the Casamoto appeals to all of us.
It was the Charles Laughton version that I've seen the most times. Now, I know you worked with Charles Laughton, including working with him on an unproduced version of Fahrenheit 451. Did you ever talk with him about how potent The Hunchback of Notre Dame was for you?
Yes, I did. And we had a wonderful friendship. For a whole year there, about 30 years ago, I worked on a science fiction operetta for Charles and Elsa Lanchester, his wife. So that meant I was over at the house at least one day a week for almost a year. And he put on performances of the various Shakespearean plays for me, or scenes from the plays, scenes from Othello or Hamlet, or he did Lear at in England 1 year, and I was privy to his ideas on how to do Lear, or when he directed Major Barbara or The Apple Cart by Shaw. And the one thing that Charles Laughton gave to me that I've kept as a gift for all the years and has changed my life is him saying to me, use language for God's sake, because there's no language in the American theater anymore. We have no playwrights who use language, who care about saying something so beautiful and so correct. It has to be correct, it has to be true, but it can be beautiful, that it moves the heart and changes the lives of the people who see it. So when I went into full-time theater work, where I actually started when I was 12, but came back into it when I was 30, I dared to write language plays, and I'm still writing them. You can listen to what I have to say, and it sounds good as well as being true.
I want to get back to the fear that you felt when you were in the dark climbing up the stairs as a child. Is that kind of terror good experience for us, for a writer, especially someone who spends part of their time writing science fiction?
Or fantasy or any other thing. Mm-hmm. Any experience that touches you in any particular way is good. It can be a horrible experience. I saw a car crash when I was 15 here in Los Angeles, and five people died as a result of it. I arrived at the scene of the accident within 20 seconds of hearing the collision. It was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. I didn't know what I was running into. People had been horribly mangled and decapitated. So for months after, I was shaken by it. It's probably the reason I never learned to drive. I was terrified at automobiles for a long time after that. But I turned it into a short story called The Crowd 6 or 7 years later, and that was part of my Ray Bradbury Television Theater 2 years ago. It was one of the things we produced. So out of this horror, this really terrible event, you take something that has taught you a certain kind of fear, I suppose, and you pass it on to others and say, this is what the car can do. This is an example of what the car can do.
You know, some writers have made a lot out of the fact that you don't drive. You know, the irony, one of America's premier science fiction writers, envisioners of the future, doesn't drive a car. Has that ever seemed ironic to you, or do you just accept that there's reasons you don't want to drive?
No, it's no different than love poetry, is it? We don't write love poetry in the middle of an affair, do we? We write love poetry when we're away from our loved one, or we anticipate a loved one. It's lack that gives us inspiration. Huh? It's not fullness. Occasionally fullness can do that. But not ever having driven, I can write better about automobiles than the people who drive them. I have a distance here. Perhaps I have a secret yearning to own a Maserati someday and go to hell. I don't know. But space travel is another good example. I'm never going to go to Mars. But I've helped inspire, thank goodness, those people who have built the rockets and sent our photographic equipment off to Mars. So it's always a lack, though, that causes you to write that kind of story.
Have you had any direct correspondence with astronauts who've traveled through space?
Well, I've met most of them, thank goodness. Life magazine sent me down to Houston back in early 1967, and I met 60 of them. The Apollo missions were just beginning. So I got to meet almost everyone who finally wound up on the moon, and I bump into them on occasion over the years. It's a wonderful part of my life. I feel very fortunate that I not only started out with Buck Rogers in 1929, but wound up down at Houston, Cape Canaveral, in my own lifetime. I thought I would be a very old man by the time we landed on the moon. Well, I was only 49, and I feel privileged to be part of this greatest age in the history of the world.
Let's talk about some of your movies. Now, Fahrenheit 451 was made into a movie directed by Louis Malle.
Francois Truffaut.
That's
okay.
The Illustrated Man was made into a movie. Now, you actually wrote the screenplay for a book that had nothing to do with your books, Moby Dick.
That's right.
And you really, I have to say, seemed like a very unlikely choice to adapt Moby Dick for the screen. And I was wondering how you got to write the screenplay.
Well, by staying true to my own sense of the poetic. Again, here's where the influence of Shakespeare on my life, the influence of the Bible, which I was raised on. And by staying true to my love of poetry and my love of metaphor, which you learn from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and you learn it from Shakespeare, to speak in tongues that are so vivid that people remember the metaphor. And also by staying in love with dinosaurs. I fell in love with dinosaurs when I was 5. And I was walking along the shore with my wife one night down Venice, California, this 1949, and we found the ruins of the old Venice Pier, all the bones and the skeleton, the tracks and the ties of the roller coaster lying there in the sea. And I turned to my wife and I said, I wonder what that dinosaur is doing lying here on the shore. She was very careful not to answer, and 3 nights later, and I heard something in the middle of the night. I sat up in bed, looked at all the fog out beyond the window, and way out in the Santa Monica Bay, I heard the braying, the calling, the oconing of the foghorn over and over and over again. And I said, yes, that's it. The dinosaur heard the foghorn blowing, thought it was another dinosaur calling from a billion years of slumber, and swam for an encounter, discovered it was only a damned lighthouse and a damned foghorn, tore the whole thing down, and died of a broken heart on the beach. So next day I got out of bed and wrote The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, sent it to the Saturday Evening Post. It was published. John Huston read that one story, huh? And that changed my life forever because he thought he smelled the ghost of Melville in that story. What he smelled in it was the ghost of Shakespeare and the ghost of the Bible, huh? And so he called me on the phone and offered me the job. A year later, when I was working on the screenplay one night, I said, John, how did I get this job? You know, everyone thought you were crazy. He said, well, I read that story about the dinosaur. And I said, well, I was very honest with you. I told you when I met you, I'd never read Melville. But once I got into Melville, I discovered he had been inspired by the same people who inspired me. So we were twins. He had been called upon by Shakespeare to cough up the white whale.
You've spent a lot of time imagining what the future might be like. Mm-hmm. What would you most like to be around to see about the future?
I'd like to come back every 50 years and see how we can use certain technological advances to our advantage, say in education. I think we're doing a dreadful job of educating now. We're spending $200 billion a year, $300 billion, whatever the figure is, a heck of a lot of money, and we're getting very small results because we're neglecting the first grade and the second grade. That's where the whole thing lies. And we have to revamp all of our ideas about the first and second grade, which means intensifying...
Wait a minute. You don't want to come back and find out if we've landed on Mars or not, and if there's life on Mars. You want to come back and see how the grade schools are doing.
It's not going to do any good to land on Mars if we're stupid.
Uh-huh.
And I want to save the future generation. I want to teach them to read when they're 5 and 6 and 7 years old. If we don't do that, we lose them forever. It's no use having remedial reading, which takes years of time, when you can do the whole thing in the first grade. We have to intensify our objectives there. It won't cost any money. It doesn't cost a darn thing. First grade is very cheap. It's the later grades where you got to spend money if you don't do it right.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ray Bradbury recorded in 1988. This week at the National Book Awards ceremony, he was given the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, You Can Count on Me. This is Fresh Air. You Can Count on Me is a new independent film starring Laura Linney. It's Linney's first lead role in a feature film, and film critic Henry Sheehan says it's about time. Linney starred in the TV adaptation of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City and was featured in Absolute Power. Here's Henry's review.
In You Can Count on Me, the directing debut of playwright and screenwriter Kenneth Lonergan, Laura Linney demonstrates just how much a superb performance can lift a movie above its limitations. Set in a small town in upstate New York, the movie is an often perceptive study of a loving but tension-filled relationship between grown-up siblings. One of them, played by Mark Ruffalo, is an iconic cinematic figure, the Ramblin' Man. Ruffalo's character, Terry Prescott, has spent most of his life moving from one city, one job, one jail to another. Now that youthful roguishness is decaying into merely tiresome immaturity, Terry has come home to borrow money and take a rest with his older sister, Sammy, who is played by Linney.
I'm so glad to see you.
Oh, I'm glad to see you too, Sammy. So you come from work?
No, it's Saturday.
Yeah, no, it's just you dress so formally.
Oh, no. You know, I thought I'd... I thought it was a special occasion. Which it is, but...
Oh, it's good. No, it's good. I thought I'd get dressed up, too.
It's okay. You look fine.
Yeah, this is the haute cuisine of garments.
What?
Nothing. So, how are you?
I'm fine, Terry.
So, how's Rudy?
We're fine, Terry. How are you?
Terry's kind of man-boy is a familiar center of cinematic fascination. Lonergan's coup is to move him from the center of attention and fill that central space with sister Sammy. Now in her 30s, Sammy is enduring what is, in a sense, a second turn at motherhood. When she and Terry were kids, their parents died in a car crash and Sammy took on parental responsibilities. And after Terry grew up and hit the road, Sammy hooked up with a no-goodnik who, before he abandoned her, did manage to leave her with the love of her life, her young son, Rudy. Lonergan has been able to orchestrate this mildly melodramatic background into a surprisingly realistic depiction of middle-class life, and not the movie middle class of 12-room houses and 2 SUVs, but the middle class of work, bills, and no free time. Sammy is a coper. She has a boyfriend, a local cop and a nice guy, whom she keeps a little bit at arm's length, not just because she's gun-shy after Rudy's father, but because, and here Lonergan's insight comes into play, she isn't quite ready to settle just for what's close at hand. Like Sammy, Linny doesn't let the sweat show. Right now, there are a lot of good actresses making movies, but nearly all of them display the same fault. Like roadside workers, they labor behind a warning sign, one that reads, "Genius at work." Linny, like Sissy Spacek used to do, simply disappears inside her character. Thus, she doesn't just illustrate the tensions in Sammy's life, she also depicts how Sammy tries to wish them away. Without losing her effective dramatic individuality, Sammy becomes an emblematic figure, the contemporary woman who knows she is overextended, but who hides that knowledge from herself. It's that lack of self-consciousness that more than anything else turns Terry's visit into both a welcome respite of unmitigated affection and a prelude to the airing of resentment. If Only You Can Count on Me was a total success. Unfortunately, like many first-time directors, Lonergan lives in fear of viewers missing his points, so he has a habit of making them 2, 3, or 4 times. When he turns to exposing Terry's less savory side, he puts him through a routine succession of bars, fights, and clumsy attempts to make things right. And in the film's most shudderingly awful scene, Lonergan turns up on screen as a priest with the answers to all of Sammy and Terry's problems. Yet even in that horribly contrived moment, Linny, or rather Sammy, looks alive and exposed. This may well be the performance of the year.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a voice lesson from voice and acting coach Patsy Rodenberg. She's trained some of the world's leading actors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.